Well, thank you. I am also not a doctor, unfortunately, it's sad to say, but I do appreciate the title upgrade. Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Matt Peterson, and I am a program manager with Project Hope. What I'd like to do today is give you a very quick presentation on our experiences as an NGO working with the Department of Defense. Next slide. I have nothing to disclose. Next. The purpose of this presentation is to, we hear a lot about NGO-NGO collaboration and various types of collaboration. What we're looking at is an alternative model, which is NGOs partnering with a country's Department of Defense, in our case, certainly the U.S. Department of Defense, and what the value added of these partnerships, what does it bring to the humanitarian operation? Next slide. Concept, NGOs partnering with the DOD, and not just the Department of Defense, but all of the umbrella organizations that are also take part in this collaborative effort. We all get on board U.S. Navy ships, and we sail around the world to various regions providing medical outreach, health education, GIK donation and distribution. When I say the umbrella organizations, it's not just the Department of Defense. It is all four services that participate, Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines, as well as U.S. agencies, USAID, the State Department, the CDC, U.S. Public Health Service are also participating. And also inviting and participating are allied partner nation governments who bring their doctors and nurses, veterinarians, and dentists on board these ships. These missions last approximately 4 months in length and go to various countries and various regions. One thing is they do stay on station for only 2 weeks at a time in each country, and we'll talk about that. How we got to where we are today, the tsunami that occurred around the Indonesia area back in 2004-2005, the U.S. Navy had a aircraft carrier, the Abraham Lincoln, which is in the photo here, was in the area and was able to provide a first responder type help to that area. Because of the magnitude of the disaster, the Navy requested the hospital ship Mercy, which is based in San Diego, to go out there and provide a little bit longer term health care in that region. Because of the number of doctors and nurses that are required to staff one of these ships, which is close to 1,000 providers on board, the Navy wasn't able to pull doctors and nurses out of war zones or out of hospitals that are providing TRICARE services to the U.S. government. They went ahead and requested throughout the United States for extra help and participation to kind of to fulfill the staffing requirement. A lot of NGOs signed up for that. We, as one, did it as well. We provided over 210, I believe, volunteers over a four-month period in Indonesia back then. It worked. Obviously, there's a lot of constraints and challenges involved with that initial engagement. It did work well enough that the government decided to go back in 2006 to Indonesia and do a follow-up, not so much disaster relief, but more humanitarian assistance. NGOs participated. We, again, did that as well as an organization. And this started to develop a relationship that the Department of Defense not only provide defense of U.S. national security interests, but also have a lot of resources to bring to bear to various regions to provide goodwill, to provide humanitarian assistance, and to do peaceful things with the types of assets that are sitting in ports around the world. And so they developed this thing called the Naval Maritime Strategy, which is a confirmed or institutionalized partnership between DOD and NGOs. Where we are today, after 2006, 2007 came around, we went back to Southeast Asia, and we also sent sent the sister ship of the Mercy, the Comfort, stationed in Baltimore down to South America, to the Latin America region. 2008, this year, we've bumped it up to 3 missions per year. We're also now doing West Central Africa. For a future outlook, by 2009, they're looking at doing up to 4. So these things are certainly not going away anytime soon, and if nothing else, are actually increasing. Why we find this partnership to be, again, with challenges, understand, relatively effective is the fact that the NGO and the DOD all certainly have strengths and they certainly have constraints and limitations. Coming together and creating a type of synergy brings the strengths and actually mitigates a lot of the weaknesses that the other side has and allows for a relatively effective partnership. And it's a new partnership, so it's something that's still certainly evolving. For the NGO side, what do we bring that can really bring to help to the Navy from their perspective is we have systems in place where we can go out and recruit world-class healthcare professionals from around the country, from teaching hospitals and medical centers around the different parts of the country, and bring those volunteers to these things and allow the military providers to stay in the hospitals or to stay overseas and wherever they may be. So it's technically free doctors and nurses that we can provide to them and saves the U.S. taxpayers a lot of money. In addition, we also have systems in place where we can reach out to donors and solicit much-needed gifts in kind, from pharmaceuticals, vaccines, supplies, and equipment we can bring and, again, provide free on these ships that the military does not have to use taxpayer dollars to pay for. And probably most importantly, NGOs have on-ground healthcare programs set up in many countries around the world. That institutional experience and knowledge is certainly very beneficial for these. Cultural awareness, the language skills that are involved, and the contacts with USAID or their ministries of health, local NGOs, and even the community add a lot of value. And finally, when we talk, one of the biggest concerns I think a lot of people have is the kind of hit-and-run medicine of being in country for 2 weeks and then departing. We find that the NGO can fill in that gap by participating during the 2 weeks, establishing contacts, and then hopefully stay on for longer-term programmatic opportunities that may be there, and do that monitoring and evaluation or follow up on patient care or monitor the GIK distribution to ensure there's no diversion. Next slide. What are the strengths of the Department of Defense? Why would we want to participate? Well, they provide a large number of resources and are very logistic-heavy to make these things valuable for us as an NGO. Certainly, they have a large operating budget. Each ship runs approximately $20 to $22 million that are budgeted for those ships, per region, per year. If you go to certain local regions, you know, you may have a community health clinic there. Now you've got a floating level 4 tertiary hospital that can show up with operating rooms, CAT scans, MRIs, diagnostic lab, x-ray, all of those capabilities can go right to the source. Life support functions, NGOs don't have to go out and contract for in-kind housing. They don't have to look for hotels or meal contracts or transportation contracts. All of that is provided by the ship. They can work ashore, come back and sleep, do laundry, internet, air conditioning, showers, meals. Everything is provided by the Navy. For security, one of the big misperceptions is the Navy goes on and provides, you know, weapons ashore and does all these kinds of militaristic things. That's really not true. In that photograph, you see the host nation has buy-in, and what the Navy does is actually coordinate with the ministries of defense for local police security, and has it's more of a community-built effort. And finally, transportation platforms. Next slide. With the majority of the world's population, I believe it's 95%, living in coastal areas, the Navy ships are able to access a large part of the world's population. Where they can't, and where there's maybe inaccessible roads, there's poor infrastructure, going to very remote, austere locations inside the country, these ships have a robust amount of, no, large number of helicopters that can carry supplies and people deep into countries and access areas that sometimes even the local government cannot access. Next slide. Well, we're not at the point of doing outcomes at this stage in the game. We do have a number of outputs to give you an idea of what we've done. This is for Project Hope over the last 4 years. We've done 9 missions. We've seen close to 300,000 patients, and we've either distributed or donated or used on the ground close to $31 million in GIK, and as you can see, over 250,000 doses of vaccine that were provided that was done in coordination with the ministries of health. Next slide. Before I conclude, I'd like to do two real quick cases to give you kind of a flavor of what these really look like. In 2007, we had a ship go to a variety of countries, and Papua New Guinea was one. As you can see, we treated close to 5,000 patients. Each patient received up to 5 services, and that could have been vaccines, an exam, optometry, dental, and possibly even onboard surgery. We provided immunization stations. We had a fair number of volunteers on board, and we either used or donated over $1 million in GIK. The bottom right slide, you can see those are our outreach sites that we use. Some are coastal and some require those transportation assets to get deeper into country. And the top right shows some community outreach education that took place. And the bottom left is a medical outreach site. Those patients had just been registered with their own host country using their own forms and documentation and are now coming in to get treatment. Next slide. Maybe a little more germane to recent times. Go Naive Haiti this past summer. We had a ship, the USS Kearsarge, down in Latin America. It was in Santa Marta, Colombia, doing work. 2 days from heading to Panama to do more humanitarian work, when the third hurricane struck around Gonaive, there was a call put out for the Kearsarge to please come assist. There was nothing in the entire Latin America region that had the capability to pick up all the supplies that were starting to build up in Port-au-Prince Airport and get it out to Gonaive. The flexibility of the ship to immediately leave Colombia, sailed directly and got to Gonaive in 2 days, and was able to deliver within 3 weeks over 3 million pounds of disaster relief supplies to the city, as well as providing assessments and patient care. It took that 19 days before the next asset from the UN, from the country, any country around the world, and from any organization around the world to be able to get to Haiti in time to pick up and relieve the Kearsarge of doing that. So it's very flexible, very creative, and very fast and responsive to disaster relief efforts. These ships are typically going out in the summer times, and as such are typically in the areas where there are during the hurricane season and are quick responders to those cases if they were to arise. Next slide. So to conclude, you know, certainly there are a number of challenges and some issues associated with partnering with the Department of Defense. We recognize that and understand that. We've been doing this for 4 years, and so it is an evolving process. We're not where we want to be, and it's going to take time to get there. There's a lot of lessons learned that are being created daily that we're implementing and also trying to look, you know, the low-hanging fruit versus the long-range plans. But they are effective, and the synergy and the resource sharing that these two agencies and organizations can do by coming together do provide good outcomes. And finally, we do see that these are increasing in scope and size every year. We're looking to hit 4 next year, and we don't see those going away anytime soon. So I would encourage, if anyone has any questions or concerns or are interested in this type of partnership, to please see me afterwards. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Pearson. The last speaker is Dr. Cooley, and she will be giving an example of how the things which we have talked about in terms of bringing together and how to make the partnership really effective.
So
meetings, one in the spring and one in the fall. We do collaborative planning. We've got working groups. We have plenary sessions. We plan together. And you can have multiple members from your organization participate. So you've got sort of multiple points of interaction. So for example, in my organization, you know, I connect to the HIV working group, but I have somebody else on my staff who connects to the TB working group. I have somebody else that connects to the monitoring and evaluation working group. And you connect all those dots, you have a deeper, more comprehensive overlay or intersection of collaboration. It's not just one point, one person in the organization. The other thing is that you combine collaborative planning, joint proposal writing, but also co-creation of documents, toolkits, that kind of thing to the working groups. So you might have somebody from another organization bring an idea, a model, a best practice to a working group. There might be some planning about that. They might document that, put it into another form, maybe a presentation, or maybe a how-to guide through the working groups that's developed, and then it can be shared and disseminated more widely. Comes back, maybe your idea came from Project Hope, but then I can take advantage of that and disseminate it to my field staff through my own networks. So there's sort of a multi-dimensional way of collaborating. It's not just one-dimensional. There's a particular benefit, I think, in coming together in a network like this from an organization like Project Concern for a couple reasons. One is we are out here in San Diego, away from the Beltway, away from the center of the universe, Washington and environment. And though I love that, I also sometimes feel out of certain loops. So it's really great to be able to connect into a network. I can pick up the phone or email. I can go to those meetings and be connected a little bit more to the inner sanctum. Another thing is that PCI is what I would consider a medium-sized private voluntary organization, NGO. We're not a small, very small grassroots, but we're not a Save the Children, CRS, World Vision. So it's particularly important for us to be able to find those opportunities for collaboration and learning because we don't have a huge amount of resources and we're relatively small. So CORE provides sort of a space for collaborative planning and connecting and coming together, but they also facilitate that. It's not just a space in their annual meetings or through the, you know, the listservs and all of that, but they facilitate because they're a secretariat. They function as a secretariat at the global level, the headquarters type level, but they also have secretariats in the field. They have malaria secretariats, they have a polio initiative, so there are polio secretariats. PCI is participating in that in India. And those secretariats play a facilitative role. Collaboration is often difficult because it takes volunteerism. There's really very few donors actually pay for the time it takes to do collaboration. So you're kind of volunteering your time in that collaborative process. And we all have competing priorities and a lot of other things going on. So unless you have some secretariat type function in the mix, you're going to tend to sort of disintegrate, I think, into all those other competing priorities, if that makes sense. So the secretariat can help, you know, pull you together, remind you about deadlines, remind you about an opportunity, communicate for the network or the collaborative group. So I think that secretariat facilitative function is really important. And I was interested by the models that Gopal presented, the bilateral and the multilateral models, they're not mutually exclusive. You can have a situation where you've got a multilateral, like a network, like CORE, but then it can facilitate a bilateral connection with two organizations collaborating on a proposal for funding or toolkit development or a research process, a project or what have you. So they can be combined. And it's not just between like organizations. In the example of polio or pandemic influenza, which is another initiative that CORE is helping to fund and facilitate and be a secretary for that PCI is involved in, or malaria, there's an opportunity to collaborate with local government, with global policy through their listservs, they can share that back to their members. So we don't necessarily have to go to the big meetings for those major alliances, but we have a representative in CORE, or CORE can ask me to go to Geneva or go to wherever and present or connect as a representative of CORE, which is what I'm doing today, for example. It also helps link on-the-ground implementation and project management, project implementation with the advocacy arena. I think that's an important thing. We are all community-based organizations in CORE, so we're often so busy just in the community doing the work that we often don't have the chance, especially if we're not a large PBO with a legislative analyst budget and department and all that, we don't often get to do some of the advocacy work. So CORE helps us connect dots, not just horizontally across organizations, but also between levels of project implementation at field level up to advocacy and policy dialogue. So that's another sort of element of the collaboration. This idea of pooling capacities, bringing together like-minded or like-hearted, I guess, organizations, but that have different experiences. One of the ideas that's come up, and I think we were talking about dating earlier, marriage, other things, which often comes up when we talk about partnership. One of the things that we played with at CORE is that is speed dating, which is, you know, we have these working groups and they're all doing their planning, but they are, they become siloed, just like we're always siloed in our work, unfortunately. You know, we've got HIV over here, and we've got the TB, we've got safe motherhood, and social behavior change. We don't connect together, so we've been trying to figure out how to even, be more vertical, I call it. So you've got the vertical, you're interested in this sector or this effort, and you have to be vertical to go in depth, but then how do you have the horizontal piece so that you're connecting and collaborating across, even within the network, how do you hope that ensure partnership between the working groups? Appropriate partnership. So it's not just some chaotic mess. You've got that verticality, but you've also got the connections across. So we've been struggling with how to implement that within the organization. Speed dating is during a meeting. You know, you spend time in your planning in your individual group, but then you also do this quick intersection with each other working group and do have some discussion about how you could collaborate or where there's some common interest or common ground. So, challenges, I know we've talked about some of the challenges, and I want to focus on the sort of ways that CORE has been addressing them or is experiencing some of these challenges. It takes time to build trust, to establish partnerships. There's a big push in the U.S. government for new partners in the Malaria Initiative or in PEPFAR or what have you, and that makes it even more complex. It does take time. Nobody really wants to pay for the time it takes. It's important to select carefully who you're partnering with. And competition, which was mentioned several times, is really an issue. It's been an issue for CORE. We have a non-compete clause in our bylaws because we say that as an NGO, as an organization itself, it can't compete with its members. But some of its members are large enough and are interested enough in the kinds of work that a network might do that we actually can compete with a member. And then that means that if CORE can't compete, then CORE itself is at a disadvantage and cannot grow as an organization, cannot grow as resources. So it's a real catch-22 and a challenge that we're grappling with now to change the bylaws. The incentives are a little bit messed up. We have shorter and shorter project periods. Donors want quick action, quick results. They're not necessarily interested in the time it takes to cultivate and nurture partnerships. We need to change that. And one of the experiences that we had in Haiti, where we were participating, about six or seven CORE members collaborated on a Global Fund HIV proposal that they won eventually. But some of the experiences they had there really brought to the forefront some of these challenges about competition, that if you come together and you call it a partnership when you go after a proposal, you're just fooling yourselves. It's not really a partnership, it's just convenience collaboration or convenience coming together for a project proposal. And so they really had to deal with issues of culture and values. They had to deal with clarity of expectations, having commitment
Thank you. I think now we will open it up for questions. Please use the mic over there because the session is recorded. So please use the mic. And if you have a loud voice like mine, it will work without the mic too. And please direct your question to any of the panelists over here. And before I invite questions, I do want to thank our excellent panelists for two things. One, bringing their wisdom and experience over here. And two, making me learn to sail so quickly. Thank you. Questions, please. Yes, please. Thank you very much. Thank you. That's very, very useful. Everybody else, please don't feel shy. Don't all of you raise your hands at the same time. Other questions? Please.
US military partnering with NGOs and other organizations, and
how that was seen by the population and by the governments that were in partnership with the U.S. In terms of the disaster relief effort. And they were overwhelmingly positive. The approval rating, if you will, of the U.S. government in Indonesia and Bangladesh, or Bangladesh in particular, prior to the tsunami, was around the 17% mark, and it went up to 85% positive following the ship mission. So while, you know, that is a concern, I think there are also a lot of positive outcomes that can come out of that. And you know, if you put your lawyer hat on and look around and say, well, you know, is partnering with the military, is that, you know, it's certainly, it's more, I think, more of a perception issue than it is necessarily a real-world legal thing, if you mean in terms of neutrality, because government, NGOs all the time are partnering with governments, and the funding streams are many times coming from governments, and that dictates how proposals and projects are being run as well. So, you know, I think more than anything, it's a perception thing. And as we evolve this process, I think it can certainly get better in how we do business and how maybe how it's seen. It's a new model, and it's something that you know, hopefully, if it continues and the vision is out there, that they can see that there are a lot of good things that can come out of this.
No, that's great. And thank you. And thank you really for a wonderful panel.
Other questions? Okay, if there are no further questions, the panelists will be available here for a few minutes after this, so if you need to talk to them one-on-one, please do so. And I thank you all for coming out so early in the morning and staying over. Thank you.
Paul Gates. Hi. I wanted to leave this with you. I don't know if you have a card, but I'm interested in getting NGO-CBO work more involved with the NIH from the research perspective, and I gave all my cards away, so
okay.
I apologize for this. It's gacep@nih.gov, and I'm wondering, is it possible to send me the PowerPoint? Thank you. If you, I don't know, did you have to write something up with the PowerPoint, or was it just the PowerPoint?
No, it was just the PowerPoint.
No, that would be great, and I'll follow up with an email to you.
Great.
And you're located.